Why do we, the gays, the lesbians, the queers, love to party?
Sincerely, truly, deeply, I believe that dance parties have the capacity to change the world. I believe in the transformative power of the dance floor. I believe that behind the eyes of every cultivated, manicured lady, there is a root rat just waiting to get out.
Artist Johnny Hawkins, aka Auntie Johnny, has performed this sermon-like speech many times. They're a true believer in the dance floor.
Do we have any true believers in the house tonight? Has anyone here ever been born again on a dance floor? Babies, I want to make converts of you all. That the next time you're on a dance floor, you shock yourself with how deeply you can become one with the soup.
The dance floor. For Johnny, for many queers, it's sacred. It's a place where so many things can happen.
Dancing is ancient and it's a really important way for people to communicate and to connect.
Everyone has a dance floor story.
You're on hallowed ground wherever you are. I can feel you, you know, I can see you, I can feel your energy. You can feel someone from the other side of the room.
I feel my shine come back and my energy come back and a sense of belonging, and it's okay in the universe to exist.
Then I was like voguing and I was just feeling myself so fiercely, but I felt so safe in that moment because I knew no one else around me was judging.
Parties to me are like a form of protest against like growing old. I'm, well, 42 years old now. I still love to party.
My first proper queer dance floor was on a Sunday afternoon at the Portuguese Madeira Club. Now, this is a place where families normally meet around bread rolls and footy, but this afternoon in 2017, it was a place for chaps, studded shorts and leather. Not that I was wearing any of these. I wasn't proper out to my family yet and still trying to figure out my queer look, which was pretty daggy and involved a lot of overalls. But everyone around me was in their own element, all floating around to make up this beautiful soup. Very kooky, which incidentally was the name of the party. And I wanted to be like that. Kooky, carefree. Slowly, I relaxed. The music took over. There was a room with a DJ up on the stage and people were dancing, everyone to their own beat, but together. This felt like the kind of party I wish I'd gone to as a teenager. Somewhere safe, weird, warm, with a sense of freedom I hadn't felt before. It was an afternoon of dancing that unfurled into a night and a relationship, now a shared life, a toddler, another baby on the way. And for our family, this party, this dance floor, started a whole lifetime. The thing is, when you're on a queer dance floor, you're not just dancing with your friends or exes and your future exes. You're dancing with our history. You're dancing with the ones who came before us, who fought so hard to make these spaces when life for people like us wasn't easy. I'm Farza Draki and this is Queer Renegades, a podcast series where we explore some of Australia's queer history and the renegades and rebels that shaped the queer resistance and helped create the safe spaces where I could find my people. We acknowledge the traditional custodians of the land we record on. This episode was recorded on the lands of the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation. We recognise their continued connection to the land and the waters of this beautiful place and acknowledge that they never ceded sovereignty. We also acknowledge our colonial viewpoint across many of these stories and that queer First Nations stories have lived on this land long before white settlers invaded. So the thing about queer history is that there isn't that much of it out there. There's bits and pieces here and there, and while we're sharing it more and more, especially in the last few years, there's still so many stories that are just untold. And the history that is taught, well, it's generally told through a heteronormative lens and, let's be honest, also a white lens. The queer stories, First Nations stories, migrant stories, they're all wiped away. So we figured we'd try to make something that helped piece some of these forgotten stories together. And I'm going to say this right off the bat. There's a lot we just couldn't fit in. There should be more queer history stories out there. This is just ours. And we're going to start somewhere where a lot of queer legends start. Parties. This episode is Parties as Protest.
Ruby's was just off Oxford Street on Crown Street, near Campbell Street. So you had to go all the way up these stairs and you walked in and it was all booths and a dance floor. People had their booths and, you know, it was really like people owned that booth, so you never sat in that booth.
This is DJ Gemma. She's talking about the iconic lesbian bar that opened in Sydney in the late 70s, Ruby Red's, owned by the infamous one-woman lesbian mafia, Dawn O'Donnell. Ruby's was where queer folklore was made.
And I remember one night the bikies turned up, they came into Ruby's and locked us in and smashed the whole bar up. They literally had baseball bats like you see in a movie, and they came in and smashed the bar up. And it was to tell Dawn that, you know, she hasn't paid up, she owes money. We were just sitting in the booth because they locked us in. But, you know, we're talking about a dyke scene then that was pretty, a lot of working class, pretty heavy scene. We were fighting back then for political rights and the women's movement.
My story actually meets up with Gemma's story. Without her and the other legends we're going to hear from in this series, I may have never found my people. But first, it's the 1970s, and Sydney has become the point of destination for many queers in Australia. And the gay scene is definitely thriving, at least for the gay men.
So Ruby's was on Crown Street, just off Oxford Street, and that was for the lesos, the women, but we only had that one club, really. Everything else was for the boys, so we kind of got given a shabby venue, but we loved it. It was our home, and I used to be there pretty much 7 nights a week because, you know, we were illegal then.
By illegal, Gemma means being gay could get you thrown in jail.
And it was really exciting because nobody cared about you, so you just would hang out in your community, and a lot of women cut their hair off, they were wearing overalls, they were rebelling about being a female and what does that mean, you know, all the things that come with being a female. And actually it was pretty rugged and rough and great. I always had a mohawk and wore a lot of studs. I was very much a punk kind of look with the big GP boots and, you know, heavy looking.
It was totally that section from Taylor Square down to the Exchange on both sides was all queer. Like, it was all little, everything was queer.
Oxford Street in Sydney was the hub of gay in Australia. And from how Ian Roberts remembers, it was a different world to the Oxford Street we have today.
Like, every second door was a bar upstairs. And there was such a mix of communities within the community. Yeah, that's probably what I think most. There was so much variation, because there is so much variation in our community.
We'll hear more from Ian later on in the series, but basically, being queer in the late 70s, 80s, and to some extent the 90s was way more dangerous, but also maybe way more fun.
Bars were opening suddenly from 1976 because the Labor government was trying to take action against the organised crime syndicate, which was very powerful. And because they threatened the SP bookies and the casinos, that syndicate reopened a whole lot of casinos as gay bars in the, like, 76 and onwards. So the sudden growth of lesbian and gay venues, for example, in Oxford Street, but not just Oxford Street, you know, Coogee and Manly and all sorts of places, that really transformed things from the mid-70s.
Ken Davis, one of the organisers of the first Mardi Gras in 1978, otherwise known as the 78ers, is getting a bit into the weeds here around New South Wales politics. But in short, the gay scene in Sydney was booming. And for a lot of queer people at that time in Australia, Sydney felt like a safe haven, resulting in a bit of a queer migration. You got to remember too, the 70s was a time of massive social change. It's hard to get our heads around it now, but across the world, there were people fighting against their colonizers. Different movements like feminism and gay liberation were growing. After the Stonewall riots, a group of Australians formed a gay liberation group called CAMP, C-A-M-P, all against a backdrop where being gay was still very much illegal. So things were bubbling away in share houses, meetings, and in bars.
Along with names like Patches, the Flows Palace, the Albury and Oxford hotels, it helps make up Sydney's gay Golden Mile.
Well, there's lots of other places around the town, but because I'm a gay guy, I can be accepted here.
Parties, bars, clubs, these weren't just places to go and have fun. They were where you went to be with your people. DJ Gemma understood that being with your people, that's a statement.
It's a place where you can be frivolous, you know, you can have a dance, go home. But I think there's so much more to a venue than that, because one is dancing is ancient and it's a really important way for people to communicate and to connect because it's non-verbal. And so it goes into the bones, and that's a really political statement in itself. I think exploring your body is another political statement where you're letting your hair down, just letting yourself just go crazy. Is really a political statement. In our social environment, being in the West and in an anglicised culture, I guess, parties are one way that we meet in a party sense. We really don't have in many other spaces that we can do that in.
Bringing people together is something Gemma has done for years now. When I first moved to Sydney, I was trying to figure a lot out. Picture a shy, brown, 20-something, pretty fresh out of uni. I'd been living in Canberra, which is a place I love, but at the time didn't have all that many queer spaces, unless you count the single lesbian bar called Cube. That dance floor where I properly met my partner, Tasita, it was a kooky dance floor. And if you're queer in Australia, you've likely heard of kooky. It was a place for everyone and anyone. You were welcome no matter what. Gemma and Johnny Seymour, another DJ legend in the Sydney queer scene, dreamed up kooky during a time of suffering in queer history.
Oxford Street was being devastated by AIDS.
At first, only gays and IV drug users were being killed by AIDS. But now we know every one of us could be devastated.
Late 80s, mid-late 80s to all the way through the 90s to, on and on and on.
50,000 men, women and children now carry the AIDS virus.
Which really affected Oxford Street and the venues.
During this time, Gemma and Johnny felt the music scene on Oxford Street had gotten too commercial. They kept talking about the sort of music they wanted to play, but none of the venues were interested.
It started to become more and more homogenised. Well, Oxford Street represented a certain type of music and a certain type of what is gay, you know? It was very much in the vein of Kylie Minogue, that kind of vibe. Johnny used to come to the record shop and we used to talk about all the music that we loved that we wanted to hear.
So they decided to do their own party, called it Kooky, and found a home for it, Club 77. Where Gemma and I are sitting is the exact position where the decks originally stood when Gemma played at the first ever Kooky gig.
We decided to just put on a one-off night. Right here, we are sitting in Club 77, the hallowed grounds of Club 77, which, you know, is very dear to my heart. It was just an underground club that was run by a woman who actually ran leso clubs in Oxford Street, Robin McCoy.
Gemma and Johnny instantly fell in love with the space.
And we had the one night and people turned up and loved it because we were playing music that you weren't hearing on Oxford Street. And so the people that came was like, please, can you do it again? And so that's kind of how Kooky was born. It was just like from week to week. And then somehow that started to become a weekly. We never planned it to be that. It was about being community and local, being a music community. Kooky was about music and left of field, underground dance music. For me, it's about thanking the people that came to Kooky. It wasn't about the people running it. It was about the people that came. They were the ones that made Kooky. To be really fair and honest, because they embraced everything we gave them. It didn't matter what we threw at them. They were dancing to Waves. We used to play Waves and they danced to it. you know. It's like, what the hell's going on here? Right? That's how nutty it was. Kooky was nuts. It was queer, but it wasn't like, oh my God, you can't come in. No. Everyone was welcome. As long as they connected to the venue and the vibe here, they were welcome. We were definitely an expressive community. It wasn't just Kooky, but yes, Kooky was very colourful. I think people felt really comfortable to explore their multitudes and come here and wear whatever. But we also created that here because we had art exhibitions and different kinds of music that would come through. People would come that may have not come, but they came because that band was playing, and then they realised they could actually express themselves with what they wore, and it was always over the top. A beautiful gay man used to come here who came as a tree. And he was like nearly 7 foot anyway. And he used to come and wear the most nuttiest things. And Robin was totally with us and behind what we were doing. And that's the only reason why Kooky survived, is because the people that owned the venue believed in us. There is no way this would have lasted if it was on Oxford Street in the time. It took an army to make Kooky last as long as it did. It took a whole lot of people. It wasn't just us.
I remember when I first moved to Sydney, Kooky was, I think, probably the first queer party I went to.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And it's actually at a Kooky that I got together with my partner.
Oh, right.
And so I guess I have a really special connection to Kooky. So I just wanted to say thank you, because for a while we were celebrating our anniversary around the October long weekend, because that's when it was. So this was 2017.
Oh, wow. Was that at the Madeira Club?
Portuguese Madeira Club, yeah. Were you there that day?
I was there at every Kooky.
Of course.
I ran Kooky.
Do you remember it?
I do. Yeah, it was a great venue.
But it felt very special. Like, as someone who hadn't been to a queer party before, I just remember thinking, oh, everyone just seems very free and kind of able to be themselves. And it was gentle too.
Right.
Like you said. And that's how that was my in, the sort that's of really the queer beautiful. Community in Sydney.
Well, I guess you've come in on the back of many years, so people knew each other. It was a very developed community of Kooksters that were family, and Kooky was their family. And
you're also responsible for a Kooky baby. And now a toddler. Aww. So.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. I'm sure there's a few of them. Oh, yeah.
There was definitely a baby conceived in here. There was.
In Club 77?
In Club 77, and they're now 22 or something. So that was really early. Yep, definitely right here in the toilet. So, yes, and there was another one conceived in the car in the laneway, I think. Their blood would be full of glitter.
Probably, yeah. Eventually, Kooky left Club 77, but it continued to be fiercely loved in its many forms and in many different venues over 27 years. And going to a Kooky was a big deal. I remember long, long lines when tickets were on sale in person on a Saturday morning. You'd see people in line, all bleary-eyed, and then at the party, there they'd be again, but this time dressed up. And I'm not talking everybody wear a pink cowboy hat dressed up. More like, hey, there's someone dressed as a bird. Or look, there's someone with a giant papier-mâché eye doing hula hoops. They were part of this world I'd never had access to before. And over the years, I went from feeling country shy and anxious to free, accepted. Now, I'm not religious, but it is the closest thing to queer communion I've seen.
It was born at a time that's really, really different to today. People protected it because they could see that it was really vital to protect this little movement.
The Kooky community was a movement of support, care, and love. Another party that also produced a big movement was Mardi Gras.
The word gay was seen as a dirty word. We weren't accepted by society. We fought really hard for gay rights, and Mardi Gras was born out of that. It was a political movement. It was grassroots. It came from the streets.
June 24, 1978, Sydney. Various gay and lesbian protest groups marched through the city during the day in support of gay rights and in solidarity with their friends in San Francisco. But this wasn't a party. It was a protest with placards and chanting, the sort of thing gay and lesbian liberation groups had been doing for years. But then a few people said,
why don't we have a nighttime street party in Oxford Street? Which, you know, we'd never done anything like that before. So I thought this was like a really risky idea, but most people, like from the Communist Party, from Sydney University, from CAMP, from other groups, thought it was a great idea. And the idea was people could come in costume and it'd be nighttime, there wouldn't be television cameras. I'm Ken Davis. I grew up in Sydney near Macquarie Uni, and I was one of the organisers of the first Mardi Gras and the other events on 24th of June 1978.
This party, this first ever Mardi Gras, is a party that changed the course of history for queer people in this country. It was a party that shouted out to the world, "We're here, we're gay, deal with it."
I was wearing a country and western frock, which, you know, because I'm from Tamworth originally. No natural fabrics, of course. It was mission brown and yellow polka dots. So, you know, high fashion. I think everyone was, like, really nervous. And it had been built by, you know, word of mouth and organisations and posters and, like, flyers. So we didn't know if it would work. But I suppose because we had a permit from the police and we had, like, the truck there with sound, with a banner saying International Gay Solidarity, 10:30 or later, we had critical mass to do something modest, like down one lane in Oxford Street. And so we started out and we had a sound truck playing Tom Robinson's Sing If You Are Glad To Be Gay, which is pretty depressing. And we had Meg Christian singing Ode to a Gym Teacher, which we're not really allowed to talk about anymore because it's, you know, about intergenerational lesbian sex. Neither of these are dance, you know, danceable. So a lot of people that were not involved in any way in lesbian or gay groups, you know, saw the opportunity, like came to join because it was a celebration rather than a protest. You know, there was no banners and placards and stuff except on the truck. But people were yelling out things like ho, ho, homosexual, or out of the bars and into the streets. And so it became real. And so maybe we had 500, and then, you know, by the time we got to Whitlam Square, we had like 1,500 or 2,000. It was exhilarating because it's before anyone had ever done anything at night. So to have like a lesbian and gay identity thing, celebration, in the street at 11 o'clock in Oxford Street was extraordinary. And to have, like, to feel the freedom at night, or, you know, the Tom Robinson song called Power in the Darkness, because we knew that we were confronting, you know, the police and the government to some extent, even though we had a permit. So there's this feeling about, like, ordinary people, us as lesbians or gay men in the street, enjoying ourselves, but in a defiant way against, like, power structures that were quite malevolent.
Ken in his frock and the others in this night party, they had joy. This was a liberating moment. But in a flash, the atmosphere of the party changed. And it became clear the police weren't happy about a bunch of gays sashaying down Oxford Street.
The police that came on duty were extremely shocked. Like, there was this bunch of lesbians and gay men coming down Oxford Street as if they owned the place in the middle of the night, literally in the middle of the night. And they just kept us going faster and faster. People were literally running rather than dancing. And then they commandeered the truck, which meant that we had no way to communicate with people about what to do.
The plan had been to end in Hyde Park, have a boogie and listen to some speeches. But suddenly someone shouted, "Let's head to the cross!"
And at that point it becomes a march, you know, because it's defying, it's no longer a celebration, it's like a march, a protest, even without placards and stuff. And then when we got to LI Main Fountain and were dispersing, then the police blocked off both ends of the street and started arrests. And they were targeting lesbians primarily. But what was shocking to them and to us, I suppose, was the lesbians started fighting back. And they were, as when people were put in the paddy wagons, people were struggling to get people out of the paddy wagons. So there was like tug of war with people like Robin Plaister, you know, with police on one arm and lesbians on the other. And the level of violence was quite high, you know, from the police, and the police had removed their badges.
Other people in the cross saw what was happening and they just jumped in.
they saw a fabulous opportunity, like a choice between like lesbians and gay men fighting the cops and the cops. Well, you're going to be on the side of lesbians and gay men, you know. So it became like a police riot, and it was like profoundly traumatic and violent. And then we had 53 people in the cells at Darlinghurst Police Station in Taylor Square. And we were outside for hours, like chanting so people could hear, trying to get lawyers and doctors in. It was very hard, you know, there's no mobile phones, there's no ATMs. So people are going to landline, you know, phone booths to gather cash for bail. So people are like raiding their rent funds at their share houses, and drag queens like Trixie are gathering money from the patrons in the clubs. And, you know, people are like literally delivering cash to like a circle of responsible lesbians that are, you know, tallying it and like packaging it for bail.
The next day, the Sydney Morning Herald published the names of people involved, resulting in many losing their jobs, their families, their friends. But for the first time ever in Australia, as a country, we were talking about lesbian and gay rights. The street parade also started another discussion, one about police powers and democratic rights.
So every union, every social movement, like Indigenous movement, the women's movement, the student movement, recognised the problem was that people had been arrested for peaceful assembly, which, you know, is guaranteed in common law from Britain.
This street party would eventually lead to a range of law reforms.
That was an enormous transformation. The trade unions and students and women's movement and civil liberties and parts of the Labor Party in the street defending our right to march, but also lesbian and gay rights, not only in Sydney, but like in every city in Australia. And we got most of the charges dropped in the next year. We got summary offences, which was this really hated body of law that gave police enormous power over public places. Wasn't only an issue for us, it was an issue for anyone that wanted to march. It was an issue for Indigenous people, for sex workers. It covered everything in public places. So getting that repealed was an enormous victory.
We'll talk more about those legal impacts later on in the series. But that first Mardi Gras started off a chain reaction. Suddenly people were fighting and continue to fight for an entire system change, a fight for everyone to be equal. Now the parade, which of course has its own critics, still serves as a defiant flag, yelling out, "We're still here." Even when parties weren't changing things on a scale like Mardi Gras, they were changing people's lives. There generally aren't a lot of spaces where you can feel pure, unbridled joy. And parties are one of those few spaces.
So you lived in two different worlds, like, you know, shame when you go home, not feeling comfortable in the way you look, as opposed to feeling great when you're out. So you almost created two personalities in order to get through it. But also you knew you could never fit in. Doesn't matter what shirt you bought to make sure it looked okay for my family, it didn't. It never looked right. We need to have physical spaces that we find each other in. So I think that it's really relevant and important to keep physical spaces going.
Gemma comes from a Lebanese family. And so for her, Arabic music was an important part of her identity. But the mainstream gay scene were just not interested.
I used to try and play it on Oxford Street. It really didn't go down very well.
What happened? What would people do?
Well, just they were so not used to it and they hated me. Like, I definitely got some growly people telling me to, you know, stop playing the Sudanese music, which I wasn't playing any Sudanese music. The rave scene was more European. The techno was actually from Europe. That's where it really took off. So Amsterdam and Berlin. And again, it was still a Western sound. So you weren't hearing things that were from the Middle East or wherever. So for me, it was really important because I always had the attitude that if you can dance to it, it's dance music.
Gemma had grown a reputation for playing or trying to play Arabic music in her sets. So it was no surprise when two women approached her.
Fadia and Alyssa, who they were doing house parties and playing Arabic music out in the suburbs and wanted to bring it out of that and, you know, give respect to the queer Arab community. And someone put them onto me. So we met, and again, it's a similar story to Kuki in that we had no idea that it would last the years that it did.
And so Club Arak was born.
It's an Arabic word, but...
Arak. Do you mean like
I
sweat?
I say Arak. Well, it's a double meaning, sweat, and also we have a drink called Arak. I guess some people say it's like ouzo, but it's not, but it's similar. Anyway, so it's a double thing, sweat and it's a drink. So the three of us did these parties together. Club Arak was about giving respect and space for Arab queers to be able to come somewhere and feel like that's theirs and to be able to hear the music, which wasn't happening in Sydney outside of your own little communities wherever you were. There was no real, you know, especially queer. So it was really important to give a space and respect to the queer Arab community, and there was a lot of closeted Arab queers as well out there that wanted to be able to have that.
It's 2002 and the night of the first ever Club Arak at a venue on Parramatta Road in Sydney. The three of them have no idea what to expect. Will anyone even turn up?
300 people turned up, and a lot of them were kooksters, actually. A lot of kooksters turned up. I was like, wow, this is what not expected at all. And loved it and stayed till 3 a.m. and I could see the Arab girls over there like, oh my God, you know, this is happening.
This was also happening in the shadow of the September 11 attacks, a time when you weren't really popular if you were of, quote, Middle Eastern appearance. I was a kid, but I still remember that time well. Suddenly, my family weren't exotic Persians. We were terrorists.
You didn't feel safe anymore. And so Club Arak was really vital as well. It made it even more important to be present and to stand your ground and own it, you know? Yeah.
They decided to have a second party, this time underneath Broadway Shopping Centre at a space called Bar Broadway.
800 people turned up.
Wow.
And it was sweating. The ceiling was literally dripping in sweat. It was so going off.
Wow.
It was hot, you know, and it was heaving. It was massive. I wanted to play music from the whole Arab world. I didn't want to just be from Lebanese music. And also I wasn't really interested in a lot of the commercial stuff there, even though people love it and I played it. But I wanted to bring other things in as well. So there was definitely music from across the Arab countries. I was playing music that hadn't been heard in the greater context in a party sense in the queer community. It was such an incredible thing to be able to do, to actually play 5 hours, which most of the parties were 5 hours. The depth of Arabic music really touched me very deeply.
I've been to Club Arak and let me tell you, it's really nice not to hear Kylie on loop for 5 hours. Don't get me wrong, I can belt spinning around at karaoke as much as the next gay. But standing in a crowd, listening to Arabic music, even to this Persian, it was really meaningful. You almost can't believe what you're hearing. You can stand together in a queer space and hear something your parents might have listened to, or your grandparents. It's not that you want your grandparents on the queer party dance floor, although, why not? Anyway, I'm getting off topic. In short, it's very special.
It was a really incredible journey and it just made me melt because you weren't going to hear that anywhere else and it gave you a sense of who you were, who you are and where you come from, and that the music's so strong and deep and old, and, you know, even if it is pop, it's still coming from a root, you know. It just gave me a real sense of something deep. I can't even put it in words. So it was an amazing thing to look out onto the dance floor. We're talking about 1,000 people packed, dancing, going off to this music that I'd never experienced like that before in that context of that music. Like, it's like, wow, this is, and queer, you know, and similar to Kuki in that multi-generational, you know, different kinds of people would come in. People from out west would come in because they felt safe to come there and they were queer, but not out to their families. And that was huge. That was really important to be able to have that.
Must have been amazing to have lots of people who were in the closet kind of come and have this space too.
It was. And that's why they were really expressive and letting their hair down and just being going crazy and wild, and because they knew they had to go back into their suburb and into the closet.
Did it help you bring those two compartmentalised sides together?
For myself?
Yeah.
Yeah, it did, actually. It helped me a lot to find some pride in that, absolutely.
Partying is also, according to Jetta Ruby Riley, good for your health.
From my public health background, social cohesion and joy is actually like the key to minimizing chronic illness. And that's because of our social and emotional well-being.
Jetta Ruby Riley has a background in public health and now is an organizer of events like Bubba Jetta's. We'll hear more from her later. But for now, she's basically explaining how going to that rave, it might just help your overall well-being.
Our social emotional well-being is actually what's leading to things like heart disease, and our overall wellness has a great deal with our physical health. So moments of joy, taking time in your life for moments of joy, is what makes you happier, makes communities more cohesive, connects us as people, and that does actually lead to better, healthier lives.
So this is an official public health policy message, because you've done research in that space.
Exactly.
So the parties we've spoken about and many more we haven't have had lasting impacts on the queer community, from pushing for law reforms to creating safe spaces. We've all got our story. The queer party, the queer bar, queer event that played a crucial role in helping us accept ourselves and find our community. And it's because of people like Gemma and Johnny, Alyssa, Fadia, Ken, the 78ers, all these party organisers that put on these events in their own time and generally with little to no money. So next time you're on the dance floor, think of Ken in his country frock dancing down Oxford Street. Gemma bringing her Arab tapes to the deck. Think about how you dancing on that ground, taking up that space, is a small act of protest. This has been Queer Renegades, hosted by me, Baza Draki, and produced by Audiocraft in collaboration with SBS. From Audiocraft, Season 1 of Queer Renegades was produced by Laura Briley-Newton and Olivia O'Flynn. Executive producers are Lorna Clarkson and Kate Montague. Sound design and mix by Laura Briley-Newton. The SBS team are Joel Supple, Bernadette Fungnam Nguyen, Max Gosford and Philip Solomon. Theme music is What? By The Vovos. Podcast artwork is by Sienna Zadro. I want to give a special thanks to Johnny Hawkins for allowing us to use snippets from their incredible performance, Dance Floor Conversion Therapy, which you heard at the start of this episode.